Investors Chronicle.
Thursday, 24th of November, and another Companies Markets podcast coming back after an unplanned week off, but we're happy to be back here, and we are happy to have Alex Newman back in the chair, back after Checks Notes having a baby. Congrats.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes.
Welcome back. Yeah, it's good to have you back. And Mark Robinson, you've not had anything, but good to have you back as well.
No, I look like I'm expecting, but no such luck.
And Dan Jones, as normal. Hello, Dan.
Hi. Hi, John. Good to be here.
What's coming up today?
Yeah, so three segments as usual, quite thematically resonant this week. We start with Burberry, its results last week, but we're going to be talking about the company's progress and the new chief executive's plans. Then, getting a bit more seasonal, we are turning to the US. This week on the cover is our US special. It's Thanksgiving today as we record this, but that's just coincidental. Our US special looking at a few companies thrown up by our quality shares screen when we direct its attentions to the US market. So we'll be talking about that. And finally, of course, it is also the World Cup at the moment. So we are seamlessly going to talk about football and investing in football clubs. The hook there being the fact that Man United, one of the rare listed clubs, is potentially up for sale. So we will be delving into that and to the wisdom or otherwise of looking at these companies as investments.
Lovely. Very thematic, as you say. And before then, as normal, a very quick news roundup of what's been going on this week. Now, we won't go back over the Chancellor's autumn statement from last week, but if you missed that, I don't know how you could, but the details are on the most austere tax and spending measures since 2010. We've got all the analysis you need online and yeah, everywhere I see. Yeah, as I say, a little bit of a quieter one this week, but still plenty of companies to update you on. First up, news this week, another investigation into fast fashion retailer Boohoo has found more evidence of poor treatment of workers. The Times put an undercover worker into a Boohoo warehouse in Lancashire who reported he would walk 13 miles to a shift in temperatures of over 30 degrees at times, all while monitored by a device strapped to his wrist. In 2018, the FT reported Boohoo suppliers were paying £5 an hour as their top wage. So more of the same there. And Boohoo shares were off 2% on Wednesday as a result. And they are down now 68% this year. An unnamed North Sea operator is under investigation for flaring, the burning of natural gas and venting, releasing gas into the atmosphere, by the North Sea Transition Authority, which is responsible for permitting. They have said that the investigation could result in, quote, action being taken, including a fine or the relevant license being taken away. Legal services firm Knights has attempted to reassure shareholders that trading is back on track after a profit warning earlier this year caused shares to tumble by 45%. In a trading update for the 6 months to 31st of October, Knight said adjusted profit before tax had risen by 18% to £9 million. And news has come in this morning as we record that Twitter has disbanded its entire Brussels office. While small, the Brussels office was seen as a key conduit to European policymakers and has sparked concern among EU officials about whether the social media platform will abide by the bloc's stringent new rules on policing online content. Elsewhere, Bill Ackman, the billionaire hedge fund manager and founder of Pershing Square Capital Management, has revealed he's shorting the Hong Kong dollar, arguing it's only a matter of time before the currency's peg to the US dollar breaks. That's all from me, Dan. Back to you and the rest of the show.
Thanks, John. So, yes, we will begin with Burberry and the third quarter earnings season for consumer discretionary stocks in general. Burberry, you know, is a slightly different to set the scene somewhat from some of the European peers, LVMH, companies like that, insofar as it's been a bit of a laggard in recent years. Its margins are lower and so on and so forth. There's also a bit of a turnaround needing to happen there with the arrival of a new chief exec. Nonetheless, its results out last week, as we say, were fairly decent, helped by a weak pound. And this seems like a sector, Alex and Mark, consumer discretionary is another sector where, you know, it's a case of so far so good. Earnings in recent weeks have been strong. This is another sector where perhaps it could be seen as recession resistant. Alternatively, you might say, if you're a bit more bearish, that it's still too soon to say, you know, whether these even better off consumers, you know, able to buy these kind of goods, whether they will continue to do so in the same volumes and in the same number as economic difficulties are brought to bear. So, Alex, maybe we'll start with you. What's your thought on Burberry, consumer discretionary in general? How do you sort of view that sector at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, so you sort of spell out quite well there. It's, when you compare the company to someone like LVMH or Hermes, you're almost bifurcating or separating the luxury tiers within the luxury category. So, you know, someone like, a company like Hermes, you know, the price point there, some of their lines are at, and some of their markets are so exclusive, so high end that, you know, comparing your sort of the margins of Burberry to them, it's sort of you're not really, it's not even really in the same category. So Burberry, I mean, sort of seen probably slightly lower down the in the high end luxury tier, even though, you know, the goods they sell are you know, very expensive and they're kind of operating in pretty rarefied air in terms of the retail sector. Yeah, I mean, I think it's possibly too soon to say. I mean, Chris, I think, you know, who Chris Akers, who wrote up the results this week, kind of said they were slightly less eye catching than some others in the consumer discretionary space have been showing in recent weeks, and that's probably fair. Burberry, you know, one of the concerns in recent years has been its exposure. Or it's kind of perennial exposure to Asia Pacific markets and the strength of the tourist trade there. You know, obviously in China we have, you know, got continual concerns about consumers there and the effect of interminable COVID zero policies on trading. But yeah, I mean the new CEO is pushing ahead and thinks that £4 billion of annual sales is doable, and I think, you know, there's quite a lot in this franchise that could be expanded, or there are opportunities for expansion, yeah, I mean, when the shares were trading quite lowly earlier this year, it's interesting. I was just looking back, they one of the companies that was screened by in March are high yield, i.e. cheap, low risk screen. And they're up something like 20% on a total return basis since then, and I think since the lows this year 40%. So there's definitely been this kind of relief rally and expectations that things were not quite as bad as they seemed at the beginning of this year. Obviously there's a currency element as well to their sales, which has been good when the pound has been so weak. Where things go from here, I think it's quite a tough call, but I mean, the, you know, setting out clear targets like that, albeit pushed out 5 years, gives a kind of a direction and a narrative to the Burberry investment case, which I think may have been lacking a little bit at points in the last couple of years.
I think what you mentioned before is correct as well, because it's certainly not in the same category as, say, Louis Vuitton. And in fact, about 10 to 15 years ago, I seem to recall that they had a real image problem as well. The image problem being is that they'd lost their exclusivity, really, and it became seen as just a normal consumer brand. Plus, there was an awful lot of hooky gear on the market as well, so everyone was sort of wearing their trademark check at one point too. So I guess you need to go a little bit more granular looking at the breakup of their sales, because you know, aspects like, you know, consumer credit is increasing or continue to increase for a while, that may have more of an impact on a company. Well, it wouldn't have as much of an impact on a company like Louis Vuitton, because, you know, if you're willing to pay £12,000 for a holdall, you know, an 8% inflation rise or, you know, an increase in consumer credit isn't going to worry you that much. So the orthodox view, I think, the further you go up the value chain, the greater the resilience, even during inflationary periods. There's one other point as well, because on the weekend I happened to be buying some high-end trainers for my goddaughter, and I got talking to a young chap in there who told me he had something like 300 pairs of Nike sneakers, that none of which that he's actually ever worn. But he says they fall into the category now alongside things like Rolex watches. And of course, we're saying here luxury goods as well, that people are buying them increasingly from an investment perspective too, which sort of underpins the market there. And I thought that was interesting. And I think it's, in a general way, it's a reflection or a symptom of all the loose monetary policy that we've had over the last 15 years or so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, trainers are definitely for some people, not for me. I tend to wear the same pair until they wear through the heels, but they're definitely a luxury good and something, yeah, to keep in the box in their hundreds, as you say, which seems unusual to us, but that is a recognisable trend. Burberry itself, it was a good point you made, Alex, about setting clear targets, you know, albeit a few years down the line, because that is, you know, the lack of such targets can be a bugbear for investors sometimes. So it's a good starting point. And I think, as Chris mentioned in his piece, that 4 billion target over the next 3 to 5 years, it is ahead of where analyst consensus was, which was, I think, 2028. So, you know, they are setting themselves a decent bar to hurdle. But let's go a little bit more granular, as you said, Mark. One thing that was quite interesting, which again, Chris picks out, was the breakdown regionally of sales and where they're happening. And Burberry's CFO said on analyst call, we've spoken about how the weak pound over the summer helped their results. They're actually, although they're to the end of September, their interim results for 6 months. But the weak pound, you know, we've also discussed it in the context of, well, this should help people in terms of coming to the UK, tourists to be keen to take advantage of the sales there. What Burberry's CFO said was that actually US tourists have been heading to Milan and Paris rather than London, which she described as really, really disappointing. Obviously, Burberry does have continental European revenues, so it's not quite as disappointing as it could have been, because their continental European business really flourished over the 6 months. UK was a bit more in line. But I suppose it's just a reminder that, you know, sterling's been weak, but the euro has been weak against the dollar as well. Everything has been until the last few weeks. So, you know, these tourists aren't necessarily going to flock to London to take advantage. And you know, Europe is a beneficiary, perhaps more than the UK, certainly as far as Burberry's been concerned. The other thing regionally was that the US itself was, you know, not a particularly bright spot either over this 6 month period. Burberry's also spoken about, you know, Chinese tourists spending a lot more in country than overseas. So I wonder if that's something we need to watch going forward, that breakdown and spending, and how, you know, insofar as it could be easy to think that the spending is slowing down. In fact, perhaps it's just being reallocated to different areas.
I mean, it might be worth watching the US, not only for this, but for a number of other reasons too, because they tightened up their central bank policy before most of their competitors. So logic kind of dictates that they'll be the first to exit that as well. And, you know, we could see improvements in consumer sentiment as a result. Although, you know, trying to second guess the global economy at the moment is a fool's errand, I think.
Yeah. Just to, I suppose, relate it back to the UK, the other thing that I think the CFO was complaining about was the reversal of the tax-free shopping plans for tourists in the UK, which was, you know, one of those many items that was dangled in September and then whisked away again the other week in the autumn statement. So,
yeah, I mean, given no one's coming to London and the loss of that tax status, interesting. They're refocusing on Britishness as like the, you know. But I mean, there's the core identity to Burberry, isn't it? And you can sort of you can sort of question the value of, you know, maybe that pull. But then they're talking to a very globalized audience, for whom, you know, British fashion culture has enormous pedigree and associations, which, you know, is the value, that is the value of the brand, isn't it?
Yeah. In theory, you should be able to sell Britishness in Paris and Milan as easy as you can do in London. But I suppose if you're a tourist, you probably want something more as a keepsake of where you are. Yeah. So perhaps that's something to keep in mind. A final thought on Burberry before we move on. We've referred to the new chief exec a number of times, Jonathan Akeroyd, and his plans. You know, could M&A be part of those plans? You know, there's mutterings only in the press rather than people in the know, I think, at the moment of you know, Burberry looking at something like Mulberry. Alternatively, Burberry itself could be taken out, although the share price rally over the past 6 months, as Alex said, has made that 40% more expensive than it would have been. But I wonder if that's something to bear in mind as well, whether M&A will form part of his strategy.
Well, I think Mulberry struggled a few years ago, didn't they? Because they went up the value chain and priced out their existing customer base to a large extent. So I don't know, it would be a fit, I suppose. But again, it emphasizes that I think that Burberry are in a slightly different camp to other European luxury brands.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. We have them on a hold currently, which probably sums it up, but there's definitely a lot going on there. For now, though, let's move across the Atlantic to the US. As I say, it is Thanksgiving today as we record, and we have our US special cover feature this week. The second time we've done this, picking up where we left off last year, we've once again used a US version of our quality screen to look for some quality shares from the US market. We won't go into detail on all of those. You can pick up the magazine to find out a bit more. But we will touch on a couple. But before that, Alex, you as our resident stock screen expert, why don't you just say a little bit more about what that screen filters out, what it doesn't filter, how we sort of start looking for these companies?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, it's what we've done basically is taken our high quality screen, as you said, that we use normally on the UK market and just applied it to the S&P 500, which if we skip back to last year, we did with in a piece that readers might remember called Beyond the Fangs, where, you know, our starting point was we wanted to look for quality shares in what is an enormous equity market in the US, and lots of companies which kind of fly beneath the radar that aren't the Twitters or, you know, or Amazons, but have lots of hallmarks of, you know, the sort of things that quality investors look for, and just pick a few of those out, partly by dint of Sterling's poor performance against the dollar. That portfolio of four stocks is actually up in the last year, which you can't say about many either screens that we've run this year or you know, general equity portfolios. That's nearing 10% on a total return basis, which is quite good. So that's outperformed the S&P 500 in sterling terms and dollar terms, I should say. But I mean, the screen itself, it's quite a... I really like it as a screen, because it's quite comprehensive in the things it screens out and looks for. So its starting point is to pick out... you know, the companies which are kind of top performers in things like free cash flow generation, their forecast earnings growth, that they need to have good balance sheets so that they can afford interest payments, you know, and that's rising for many companies, and that they've got a history of margin expansion. So companies which, you know, there's a bit of momentum there, they're on a... they're often in sectors where there's a growth story, not that the growth is necessarily explosive, but that they have enough of, and we talk about a lot of this on the podcast and in the mag about an economic moat, which means that they're going to be able to maintain their kind of market position and be profitable in doing that. So we've run the screen, we picked out four companies again this year, which are a little bit bar one. I should say, a bit more below the radar than most US businesses, and kind of pick through the valuation cases for there. So yeah, you've got four extra ideas this week in the magazine than the normal two. So yeah, that's the kind of backstory to everything.
Yeah, and Mark, you have analysed the case for one of these four companies, CSX, railroad sector, which has become a bit more familiar to people this year again, now that people are starting to recognise once more the merits of the likes of Warren Buffett, who's obviously a famous investor, not in CSX, but in the sector. But can you say a little bit more about the company and the space and what you've been analysing there?
I thought it was very interesting, actually, and it highlights the fact that these type of companies as well, that you need a certain percentage of these type of companies within your long-term portfolio too. Alex made the point there about competitive moats, and it certainly applies in the case of CSX, as it would with any large-scale transportation network in the US. That's because, you know, they've got a competitive edge because of the high barriers to entry. It's like most utilities as well. There's a huge level of sunk costs initially, and cash flows, once they start generating, are going against a smaller percentage increase year on year. So that in itself is a huge benefit for those sort of companies, and plus the rail sector in the US has gradually consolidated over the years as well. I mean, when it first started, there were dozens of different operators, and I think there's only maybe half a dozen large-scale operators back in the market now. And so it's a very difficult sector to try and squeeze into, almost impossible in a sense. And you mentioned Warren Buffett there before, but the aforementioned Bill Ackman and Bill Gates are also investors in North American rail companies too. There's a couple of other benefits that are coming through due to the energy transition and our move towards net zero. That's because, as CSX said themselves, they're going to see a growth in freight volumes, partly linked to the fact that it's a more environmentally friendly way of transporting bulk goods across, continental USA. So as I said before, I think what they said, that the freight railroads are 3 to 4 times more fuel efficient, and that's a critical point as well. And presumably, they could sort of benefit from inclusion and ESG mandates on that basis. And they, the point I was making earlier about operating expenses as well, that's now running at about 60%, whereas 5 years ago it was 67.4%, according to that. So you can see that over time, and this is partly due to efficiency programs too, that cash flows and profitability will be boosted because you're seeing costs as a proportion of revenues fall. So it's not what you'd call a sexy stock by any stretch of the imagination. But given the global economy in the States at the moment, you can see that companies like CSX have their attractions.
Yeah, I think obviously with any transportation, there is a cyclical element there, but as you say, there are reasons to think there's a structural growth story too. And I think there's also a self-help story here from what I've seen too, from some analysts seem quite keen on the improvements that CSX has been making to its own services and its staffing levels as well, so which could bear fruit next year, even if the economy takes a little bit of a turn for the worse. The other thing I suppose we should say with railroads in general, which I know you've flagged in the past, Alex, is debt levels. Obviously, these are typically relatively indebted companies, but that's not necessarily a reason to overlook them. But is something to be aware of in a time of higher rates and what have you.
Yeah, totally not out of place with other sort of utility or infrastructure style sectors. That they're highly indebted, but that is in a way, and yes, it is a bit more of a worry now that rates are you know, are ticking up, but in a way that's a validation of the, you know, the longevity of the business model and its defensiveness. And yeah, it's kind of pretty oligopolistic in the States, in that it's concentrated in just the hands of a few corporates. But yeah, I mean, it partly validates the idea that they're not really going anywhere. And yeah, we sort of talk about step changing technologies. I mean, this is, railroads are now a very old technology, but this is, you know, it was one of the greatest leap forwards in you know, in economic history, that we're able to move goods at such low costs across large distances. I mean, and it still is powering our economies today. So so yeah, it just goes to show how enduring some investment themes can be.
I mean, as you say, it's inevitable that companies like this are likely to hold, you know, a large proportion of debt. In the article as well, I point out that I think it's 118% of shareholder funds at the moment. But S&P give them a decent triple B plus credit rating, and that's on a stable basis as well. So I think it's another instance where we'll pay to drill down and just have a look at the terms of the debt too. And the conditions and covenants linked to it. But it was interesting, actually, because, I mean, it's rare that I've got to write about a company in this particular sector. So I might take a look at it myself.
Yeah. Sadly, I can't find a way, given CSX focuses on freight. I can't really find much of a way to crowbar in my recent journeys on the US rail system on my holiday last week, but they were they were very enjoyable too, so I'm sure all listeners are delighted to learn that. But let's move on. As I say, there are four companies we've picked out in the US this week. You can find more details on CSX and the others in the magazine. But another story this week, in a World Cup week, and indeed tying things together nicely today, Friday when this goes out, England are playing the USA at football. And so that is my seamless segue from the USA to football. And Manchester United, which has been in the news this week because of a possible sale of the club. Now, Man United is listed in the US, and it is held by a well-known manager, Nick Train, who has backed it for a number of years. But despite the current owners, the Glazers, ability, as many fans will perhaps bemoan, to extract money from the club, it hasn't necessarily been a great investment for individual shareholders. So even though this sale may go ahead and, you know, the club's fans may think good times are on the roll again, I think probably it's a chance to talk about and remind ourselves of perhaps the perils of, you know, investing with your heart rather than your head. Alex.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I was just looking back at the, I remember stocks, Dow Jones used to track, they track listed football clubs in an index, which they stopped actually, unfortunately, a couple of years ago. It might be because there's actually relatively few listed clubs now. But I mean, within the past, you know, the past 20 years, there have been several clubs. I mean, Rangers and Celtic were both listed. Obviously, Man United is probably the most high profile one. Borussia Dortmund and Juventus both had their own listings, and it's interesting following that that index, because for much of the last decade, it performed very poorly, and then actually in the run up to the pandemic, the index did start to perform a little bit more strongly than it had done, and yeah, I mean, there's a number of reasons for this. I mean, football clubs are a bad investment, but they're also an incredibly weird investment, because they're, you know, they're sort of this, there's this market now for the elite football clubs, which is as much about status as about returns, and you know, that's why you've got these sort of like astronomical figures being quoted for you know, potential Man United sale of like $6 billion, which is about double their current market value. But you know, football clubs, because of this, because they've become sort of less and less about returns, it's skewed the valuations, lots of the valuations within the sport or the top of the sport. So specifically in terms of players' wages and signing valuations, it means balancing the books is a real challenge, even before the immense, you know, operational overheads of sort of running stadiums and, you know, and marketing the franchise in the sort of current parlance globally is considered. So, you know, you do very... would do very, very well to make a return on football investments. Looking back to since IPO, Man United has doubled since the IPO in total return basis, but it's a bit less impressive when you consider that's just about just under half of that return has probably been made in the last week as the news of their supposed sale has broken. And you know, it's like a fifth of the S&P 500 over the same time. So, so on a comparative basis, it's not been a stellar investment for Nick Train.
Yeah, I think he would certainly be hoping for some kind of big deal to go through and help him out there. So with Man United, of course, you know, since it's been listed, it's been going through a period of relative decline on the pitch. But yeah, the idea being that, you know, I think which Nick Train would say as well, it's got that, you know, that brand power and that ability to, you know, produce commercial revenues across the world, but even that hasn't been enough to save it. I suppose another example with Juventus over the years have been, you know, obviously incredibly successful Italian team, but its share prices, you know, really not really reflect that much at all. In fact, I think the only time it really got a material boost was when they signed Ronaldo, and you know, again, the commercial potential there was seen as you know, really putting a fire under the stock for a brief period, and then it reversed. So yeah, it's very difficult to draw a line between even what you know about the commercial aspects of football and share price performance.
But, you know, and yet, you know, all the talk this week has been about how this is a seller's market for football assets. So we you know, we had the Chelsea sale over the summer. There's £2.5 billion. That was that's a record. I think the equity stake that was taken a couple of years back in Man City valued Man City at $5 billion then. Liverpool's on the, you know, supposedly on the, on, you know, they're looking at a sale as well. And then all these numbers being floated around for Man United. I mean, sort of just kind of going back to what I was saying before, I mean, you know, in the middle of a World Cup, why it might be the case that despite their questionable conventional or financial fund, you know, returns based on a fundamental basis, that why that all might still be questionable, but it could still be a seller's market. I mean, you just look at the World Cup, you know, it's being hosted by a tiny nation with zero historical pedigree in the sport, but it just so happens to be able to afford the $220 billion or whatever it is it's apparently spent on infrastructure to host, you know, a month-long event. So, but why it might have done that, and why, you know, you've got oligarchs or billionaires who are prepared to pay up without a prospect of sort of direct financial return from the clubs themselves, is that it's, you know, unquestionably elevated Qatar's global profile. That probably the case for Saudi Arabia with their, you know, they're buying Newcastle. It has been the case for Abu Dhabi with Man City, PSG. So there's this kind of like very intangible commercial soft power edge that is to be gained by inserting yourself into the conversation about the world's most popular sport. You know, but where ordinary shareholders stand in all of that, and if you're thinking, wow, Man United stock, they're talking about $6 billion valuations, and this is, you know, the market value is only $3 billion. You're making a bet on the valuation on something which is so intangible and ephemeral, which is the, you know, the kind of whims of billionaires and nation states to buy these trophy assets. So it's not an easy valuation case to make. And just to return to the point you made at the top, you know, you can get carried away as a fan, you know, if to see the investment case beyond the reality of making money from a football club. But equally, you know, the speculative investor, I think here can potentially get carried away with thinking about the valuations that are being talked up. So
yeah, it's not, we talk a lot about intangibles, but these are possibly the really intangible intangibles. Exactly. There, it's not the good kind of intangibles. And in Man United's case, you don't even get voting rights with the team either. So, but there we are. That story will develop in the background and perhaps to shareholders' advantage and to Nick Train's advantage, but that is still to be decided, of course. We, however, have run out of time this week, so thank you to Alex and to Mark and to John, as ever, and thank you to you for listening. We'll see you next time on another Companies and Markets show.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.